Hi there, and welcome to The Conscious Communicator, a show dedicated to helping you find your true voice, the nonviolent voice of personal responsibility and purpose, the voice that only you can speak. The reason that most of us fail to achieve our true voice is because of the false voices that occupy the mind. The voices of ego, consumption, expectation, opinion, and self-doubt rob us of our true nature, our true voice. Join me as we have a chat about inner purpose, outer passion, and finding your true voice. Southern Discomfort. Our guest tonight is Steve Riles, and Steve is the author of the book Drunk with Wonder.
Right.
And he's joining us today from 707. You're somewhere in over in Sonoma County?
Actually, up in the mountains of Mendocino County.
Oh, right on. Well, thank you very much for joining us. We usually come on the show today. We talk about people finding that conscious voice inside themselves. I've read a little bit about you and what you've gone through, and it appears that you kind of had a moment in your life where you kind of had a breakthrough and things changed a little bit. You want to tell us about that?
Well, I've had a few, actually. Perhaps the first really big one was as a teenager, I was wound up addicted to drugs, particularly methadone. Was shooting drugs and homeless, and had an intervention by my best friend who gave me what I think we would call today tough love. I don't know that we were calling it that back then. And I wound up successfully surviving, obviously, and it was a real epiphany for me. And within 3 weeks of that time, I had just moved home and was kind of trying to figure my world out and get healthy again, and he was killed in a motorcycle accident. So, yeah, it was a very intense time. I had the opportunity the night of the intervention where I could really, kind of an out-of-body experience where I was able to see myself as I was rather than in my kind of, you know, fantasy, drug-addled fantasy, and saw that I was indeed dying, and that I had a very stark and immediate choice as to whether I was going to continue in this body or not. And I chose to. It was really clear to me in that moment that I was one choice away, one very simple choice away from checking out. And since I had actually tried to commit suicide when I was 16 for the first time, it was very close in that sense.
But well, your friend was somewhat of an angel that kind of came along to help you through a very difficult period of time, and then his job was done.
Yeah, of course, looking back on it now, he actually continued to help me immensely even after his body passed on. I was devastated by his death. I had never experienced any of that, someone that close passing away, and certainly not suddenly. Like he was, as I said, killed in a motorcycle accident, and I know that you, Rusty, that you work with emotions and, you know, helping people with nonviolence and learning how to deal with a lot of these things. At the time, I had no clue. So, although I had quit shooting speed, I found alcohol within a couple of months, and boy, if that isn't one of the most amazing numbing agents known to man. Or women. So that's what I went off into. I stayed in the system in the sense of going back to school. I had been a high school dropout, but I went to college, started going to college, and you know, kept that kind of a straight side to me. But because I didn't have any tools with which to deal with these huge, overwhelming, what appeared to be, what felt like, overwhelming emotions, I just became better and better at numbing myself out. And that's really where I spent a lot of my life, was dancing in and out of what I might call the straight world or the routine, you know, world out there, and working on spiritual growth, and at the same time abusing alcohol and checking out quite a bit. My friend's name is Carl. What happened that summer was that he started coming or appearing in my dreams. And he had changed physically. He had never been able to grow a beard, and he had grown a beard. And you know, it was just so obviously his energy that when I woke up in the morning a couple of times, I felt as though I had just been with him, and I had to kind of go through that whole further awakening and realizing, oh, no, Carl's actually dead. That was just a dream in that sense. But it was so intriguing, Rusty, that this was happening to me, that it made me really look at some of my beliefs about atheism and being angry with the very idea of a God who could, you know, let a world like this happen. All, you know, that stuff. I'm sure you've heard that discussion many times. But it really, that was an additional gift that he gave me after he passed physically.
We get back into the idea. You talked about committing suicide at 16. I work a lot with young people, and you know, I know the desperation of that period of time. A lot of people who talk about drug and alcohol addiction, they talk about starting in the 12 or 13 year period because of that transfer into the puberty mind, into that, you know, the amygdala brain. I was reading something on your blog that talked about how you still feel like adrenaline is something that you look forward to, and that's definitely something that peaks at that period of time and lasts for a good 10 or 12 years. And a lot of times people try and find ways to create those emotions in themselves. But what do you think, you know, what do you think brought you to the precipice when you were in that, in that period of your early life? What was going, and again, I don't spend a lot of time dealing with, you know, my parents did this or I did that or whatever. It's kind of our internalization of what happened. What was it that you were thinking that brought you to that level when you were 16?
Well, yeah, and I totally appreciate what you're saying about I'm not into being a victim. I'm not into blaming at this time in my life at all. I just, like I think virtually everyone, certainly in my generation, I'll be 59 in a little over a week, we just were taught that we were wrong at our core. You know, the whole Christian ethic of being born a sinner and being made wrong.
What Christian denomination were you raised in?
Actually, I wasn't. Although my father's mother, my grandmother, was an evangelical Christian, Assembly of God, I think it was. And she did her best when she saw me, but that was only a few times a year. And I was raised in the Unitarian Church from the age of 9 on. And so I pretty much intellectually rejected that whole, you know, evangelical Christian center school by the time I was 10. But I think our whole culture is more or less steeped in it, you know, enmeshed.
Steeped in the idea that we're evil? Is that what you're talking about?
I was raised
Catholic, and I know we do guilt, like, you know, on the Jews.
Like nobody's business,
than we do,
yeah.
Or, you know, but just longer than we have been. But I'm surprised to hear you say that coming from a relatively liberal tradition.
Yes, well, it's this. Even though neither one of my parents were actively religious at all, they both rejected their Christian upbringing, there was still a sense that you're pretty much worthless just showing up as a human being, that you've got to do, perform. You know, I grew up where I was punished for getting an A-minus because it wasn't good enough. And so I had this, you know, inculcated deeply in me that I wasn't good enough. That I had an uphill climb that I could never reach, kind of like Sisyphus, you know, just rolling that boulder uphill. And so I felt really defeated. And by the age of 10, I had become overweight, and I had to, I'd had an accident when I was 6, and I had to start wearing glasses. So I was the only kid in an elementary, only boy in an elementary school with glasses, basically, in 1956. And so I, you know, I became the nerd and the geek and the teacher's pet and didn't want to fight. And I actually have never been in a physical fight in my entire life, in any kind of, you know, stand up and duke it out kind of thing at all. I was bullied a tremendous amount, and I just felt like there was no point in being on the planet for me. And so I found ways to distract myself. When I was a kid, it was food, it was reading. Those were my two really huge distractions. And then when I got a little bit older, I was, you know, I was addicted to nicotine by the time I was 13. And I just kept finding drugs that would distract me from these feelings of worthlessness and, you know, self-loathing, really. And then, you know, and then you add to that package of glasses and the nerdy kind of band guy, and the kids, you know, one of the smartest kids in the class, no good in sports, and then you put all that together with a pretty good case of acne by the time I was 13, and, you know, there was, not a lot of self-confidence or, sense of self-worth at all in any of that. So I went off the deep end, although a whole lot of people went off the deep end, around not wanting to be here, not really even wanting to be me. I also work a lot with teens through a program called Challenge Day. You may have heard of
it. Oh, right on, yeah. I definitely have been a part of those before.
Okay. So I hear about it. I'm doing a Challenge Day on Tuesday, actually, and so I hear about it from young people a lot. I have a lot of empathy for how overwhelming it can feel, and I emphasize the word feel, to even be a teen and have the hormones raging, even if you're in a really well-adjusted, conscious situation with your family and your school and so on. But if you're getting teased and humiliated and bullied and all of that kind of stuff, which most kids sooner or later experience, then it can really, really be hard, especially when you don't have any emotional literacy. When there's no sense that our feelings have worth and value, and that there are healthy and safe ways to run our emotional energy and get it out of our bodies and not store it up and not create disease. It sounds to me like you know a lot about this stuff already. And
well, you know, it's interesting to me because the idea that I'm working with now is the difference between the boys and the girls. I mean, the girls seem to have the capacity for the feelings, although they don't seem to have the capacity to let them go. And the boys don't seem to have the capacity to feel. We only have the capacity for reaction. And it's a very interesting kind of a dynamic that's going on right now in terms of trying to help them to understand that without... you know, creating, turning boys into girls or expecting that they're going to have that level of emotionality. And obviously we do. There's no question about
it. Oh, I think it's in there. Yeah.
I think it's definitely there. I don't question the ability to do it, but the ability to understand it and to deal with it and to sit with it for a period of time, you know, uncomfortable emotions are something that most of us have a real challenge dealing with.
It's true. And I think the reason they're uncomfortable is because we've never been exposed to a model, any kind of role models to speak of, that can give us some sense of how we can experience really strong emotions and not feel like there's something wrong with us. I mean, think about when we're little kids. You know, we're running around. You think of a kid in preschool or kindergartner. They're running around screaming and laughing and playing. They're fully expressed, you know, to hug your leg, to fall down, and they'll scream when they get a scratch, and then you kiss it, and then they're fine, and, you know, and then you start saying, you know, sit down and shut up, you know, close it down, you know, you're too much, you're too loud, too noisy, too active, you know, and when we're little, you know, we don't have any sense that we are anything outside of our bodies. We don't have any, you know, the first kind of abstract reasoning doesn't really begin to kick in for most kids until puberty, if we're lucky. And so we wind up, when we're made wrong for our feelings, we feel like we're being made wrong for who we are.
Let me ask you a question, though, about feelings.
Sure.
What is your, because I have, my my ideas about feelings have evolved and are hopefully will continue to evolve. But what do you think about feelings? Do you think feelings, because again, you're a religious person. I know your theory or your idea of God is not that biblical God, but more of a God of consciousness and awareness and so forth. But when you think of the word feelings in terms of consciousness, how do those two things coexist?
Well, I'll get really specific, and I would prefer, I certainly personally prefer the word spiritual to religious, which I
right
consider
on.
To be basically a codified dogma, set of a story that is then not challengeable, and I firmly believe in the evolution of consciousness and that we're all on this amazing arc, and so I really always want to be open at the top as much as I can be and not say, this is it, that's it, you know, I'm done thinking or I'm done growing, you know, I think that's the kiss of death right there.
Right.
But, to be really, really specific about feelings and emotions, for example, I really believe that the word feeling here starts with bodily sensation. I mean, you know, feeling cold, feeling hot, feeling, you know, this, my heart starts beating like crazy and I find it hard to breathe deeply. We're taught that that's called fear. And yet, one of my favorite sayings is that fear is excitement without breath. And so if we learn to, and I want to make a distinction between fear that's an entirely appropriate reaction to stepping off the curve in the face of a taxi speeding towards you, and the fear of taking a test, or the fear that someone is going to judge you because your tennis shoes aren't the right color or whatever. You know what I'm saying? The
mm-hmm.
difference there. And so we start with feelings. And when we're little kids, we have these feelings, and I emphasize bodily sensations. And we're taught to give them different names, like excitement, joy, sadness, anger, fear. And then we're taught when, if at any time, it's ever appropriate to display that feeling in any outward way. And it's really hard to feel something if you can't translate that through some kind of bodily movement or sensation or awareness. Are you following me so far?
Yeah.
Does that make sense? And then so emotions, in essence, are feelings that we have given a name to, that we have, and the name involves a story. It involves a context or a perspective. You know, when these physical sensations show up in my body, I've learned to call it anger and I've learned to stuff it. You know, and in some cases it's appropriate or it's been deemed appropriate on the football field, but then again, not too much, you know, or you get in trouble for, you know, breaking the rules or, you know, whatever it might be. So to me, feelings that start as bodily sensations and then become emotions when we label them and name them and give them a context. The pure physicalness of ourselves, to me, is the greatest gift from God. It's the gift of life. And I use the word God in the sense, as you say, of pure, undifferentiated awareness, of pure, unconditional, loving, non-dual awareness. And that this great unlimited gift is the gift of life. And we, in many ways, know that we're alive or aware that we're alive by the way our bodies feel. If think of the word depression, for example. When a person is depressed, what do they look like? Well, they look like they're barely alive, right? They're depressed physically. You know, their shoulders are hunched, their eyes are downcast, their heads, you know, they're usually looking down. Shoulders are slumped. You know, I'm sure you're deeply aware of what that looks like in young people, for example. And so when we're not depressed, when we're fully engaged in the world, there's a lot of passion. And I believe that where most people lose their passion is behind the wall they build, you know, out of all these different bricks. Each brick is a time when they've been told that what they're feeling is not appropriate, you know?
Well, let's
don't cry
or
I'll give you something to cry about, you know, stuff like that.
Right. Well, you refer to your book as being compared to What the Bleep Do We Know About Anything, which is a fantastic movie. What I took away from that movie was the idea that thoughts create feelings, and that feelings don't exist independent of thought, and thought is, in fact, the primary mover in consciousness. And so about the idea that somehow, in some way, shape, or form, those early experiences, those early physiological experiences that you're talking about become behaviors that we try and recreate in ourselves, or we find ways to do it because, as we know, in the amygdala brain of adolescence, we become very hungry for emotion. It's almost like Pac-Man eating its way through the maze when you get into adolescence because, you know, everything is up and down. We're hungry for moods. We're hungry for swings. We're as addicted to our behaviors. We're as addicted to that emotionality as anything else. And what describes itself as passion when you're 15 is completely different than a passion of somebody who has gotten to the point where their passion is something that they can express in a way that allows them to help others or to do something like that later in life. Because if you brought that passion of 15 into an operating room, chances are you wouldn't be very successful. So is there a sense that those emotions at some level are also things that need to evolve?
Well, I want to be careful here again because, you know, we're talking about feelings that start out as bodily sensations that get translated into emotions by the context in which we live. So I hesitate to talk about any emotions as inappropriate, and of course passion, I know plenty of 15-year-old kids who are passionate about making a difference in the world. I know plenty of kids who have started out younger than that. There's a 13-year-old boy in the Bay Area, San Francisco Bay Area, who's making an enormous difference and raising thousands and thousands of dollars for homeless people because of his personal passion as a young person.
It may also be the fact that he's receiving an incredible amount of attention for the fact that he's doing something that people think is good.
I kind of think that's getting the cart turned around because he wasn't getting attention when he started. He started because he was deeply moved by seeing kids who were homeless. And that moved his heart deeply. And he was able, and of course had supportive parents and so on, and he was able to do something concrete about that. He did something different in the world. I think a lot of this is really not about what's innate. I believe it's what we're taught. This is, to me, all very much a teaching situation. It's not natural or nature. I think it's been pretty clearly shown with, are you familiar with epigenetics?
No.
Epigenetics is a relatively recent science. And it is science. I read Dr. Bruce Lipton, The Biology of Belief, for example, that talks about how most of the genes in our bodies decide how to express based on the environment that they find themselves in. There's a whole lot we used to think of that was inherent or innate and fixed that turns out to have a lot more plasticity than we ever could have imagined even 10, 15 years ago. So I want to emphasize that what we often think of as, oh, that's just how boys are, or that's just how girls are, is a myth. It's a story we've learned in this culture that isn't true. It just isn't true.
No, I've read so many stories about mothers, and I was reading that about the other day, about a mother who had absolutely and totally, with two children, a boy and a girl, twins, who had done everything she could possibly do to avoid giving her boy any kind of, you know, trainings or guns or anything like that, and she was talking about how he picked up sticks and he was already pointing them at people and he was doing things that even she couldn't even imagine in her mind that was going on, so... You know, there are also a lot of stories out there about people, saying that there are in fact differences, that there are in fact different ways. We also understand that the crossover pathways in the brain, you know, the fact that men and women process information differently, the fact that we don't catch on as quickly in the language development department. Those aren't myths. Those are real. There's a real difference between boys and girls, and I think it's very dangerous to start talking about it as if there isn't. Because I think that there is some necessary, I mean, if we're talking about the ultimate consciousness, there was some reason to bring those ultimate, you know, to bring separation into the world. It didn't just give it to us and say, you know, you're going to be the same, you know, and procreate based on people being together regardless of sex. There are differences between men and women.
I didn't say there weren't. I think you misunderstood me. I'm saying that our capacities for feeling our feelings, for having emotional literacy, is very similar.
And
that's
what
a very
benefit,
specific
though?
Thing.
My question to you is, what's the benefit of emotional literacy?
Well, one example is that men die younger than women, and on a statistical basis. And they die of diseases that are very clearly understood now by the AMA, this is medical establishment, not woo-woo at all, of primarily of cardiovascular disease, which is stress-related. It's cortisol-related. Long-term adrenaline stress creates much of the disease that kills men younger than women. That's just simply in the scientific literature. This is not, you know, this is not my fantasy.
I don't think it is. But what are we and we're attributing the stress to their inability to express their emotions?
Yeah, in healthy and responsible ways, and to understand what's going on in this process. You know, the amygdala, of course, is pretty much part of the reptilian brain. It's part of this five most primitive emotions. And if we don't understand what's going on, if we don't have any awareness, then they drive us. And something you said earlier, Rusty, I want to be really clear about this. You talk about thoughts create feelings, or thoughts create emotions, I think is what you specifically said. And I want to parse that down, get really granular about it. Because from my perspective, we have a bodily sensation. That truly is first. And then we learn a story about what that bodily sensation means, what it's identified as, and whether it's safe or not to experience it or share it, you know, or exhibit it at whatever level. And it is, so it's the thought that comes, that's a story that we learn about the feeling, the physical sensation, that then becomes an emotion and whether it's okay to feel it or not. So
yeah,
it's not that the thoughts create our emotions.
Because I feel like the thoughts, the emotions are the reaction, the bodily reaction to thoughts in the brain. And everything that we realize now about the quantum experience and the idea that your thoughts create the reality around you point to the fact that the emotions are in fact secondary. They are secondary to some sort of a thought process that generates that thought, and that they are in fact secondary. And I, you know, you talked about the evolution of consciousness, and the evolution of consciousness in my mind, you know, one of the things that we're going to have to understand is that emotions, you know, and a lot of these things, you know, you talk about these emotions as if they've been with us forever. You know, emotionality really is somewhat young in the experience of consciousness in terms of some of these more sophisticated emotions that we've had for, you know, 400, 500, 600 years since people started writing the autobiography and talking about that internal sense of itself. This isn't something that's been around forever. This is something that's relatively new in terms of its evolution. And, you know, again, I wonder about that, just thinking, and again, I happen to be somebody who teaches emotional literacy. I happen to be somebody who believes fervently in it, but I'm also afraid of the fact of, you know, of the idea that emotionality is what's leading us around, that we should be led around by our emotions as opposed to our reason.
Rusty, I'm not saying that we should be led around by it. I'm saying that because we've built a wall and most of us don't understand what's going on, that we are led around by the nose by our emotions or by doing everything we can not to feel emotions. The point of emotional clearing and emotional health and releasing this toxic balloon of unfelt feelings is to think more clearly. It's not to be, to run around running on our emotions. My thesis is that, and I have a lot of backup for this, I want you to know, is that most of us really are running around on our emotions all the time, even though we swear we don't. This business about scientific objectivity is nonsense. It's just nonsense. We come into every experience we have with a particular filter, with a particular set of stories that create the meaning or context of our experience. And what we have the ability to change is what we make our experience mean. I mean, we start out with the isness. You know, Eckhart Tolle talks about this in The Power of Now and A New Earth. Talks about it very clearly. We start out with the isness, and then we use the filters that we're taught to make whatever we experience mean a particular thing. If you're a Democrat and you were really excited about Barack Obama being elected, you might have cried and felt really strong emotions. If you were a Republican and you thought that Barack was a socialist and was bringing the end of the world, then you were really, really upset and angry. The isness was that a particular person was elected. Your set of filters is what determined how you felt about the isness. That's just one example. But I'm saying that those, I can give you, you know, I can cite examples for just about anything you might bring up.
But when I listen to The New Earth, and I just got done listening to that, I'm not much of a reader, but the idea that I also said was there was a sense of taking a step back and strengthening the observer so that you could observe yourself in those situations and observe the emotions and what you were feeling and also be able to take a step back so there was a disconnect between those two experiences.
I totally get that, and my point again here is that emotional literacy is the key that I have found to being able to step back.
So that's the key to present moment awareness.
To me it is, because if we can't get fully present, we don't have present moment awareness. And in order to be, and I coach people on this and work with people on this all the time, in order to get present, you've got to be able to differentiate between your stories about what's going on in the world and what's going on in your life and what is so, what is really so in the moment. And when we are running, when we're at the effect of our emotions, we're running on a set of programs. We're not really present. We're looking to the future. We're worried or sad about the past. You know, I'm working with people who are terrified about the economic situation right now, for example, and they continually project into the future possible negative things that might happen, and then they have no capacity to enjoy the present moment, to really be fully present.
Well, that's kind of what I'm talking about, though. Those thoughts, those uncomfortable thoughts about the future are creating a negative emotional experience in the moment.
I'm not disagreeing with that. I'm not saying
back to the idea of emotional literacy, but what you're talking about, I think, is the same thing I'm talking about. You know, I'm a cognitive behavioral therapist. When I deal with cognition first and realize that behavior tends to follow cognition. And you're saying the exact same thing. When people are miserable or depressed or whatever they are, they're projecting into the future some sense that as a 16-year-old person without much to stand on at that particular age of their life, that they're projecting out over a period of 65 or 80 years, or whatever it happens to be, that life is going to continue, thereby creating a depression that would allow someone to get into a situation where they feel like that maybe their life isn't worth living, or they feel like that maybe their life is something that they need to medicate, as opposed to the idea of realizing that it's the thoughts, in fact, not the feelings, but the thoughts that are being created that are causing you to have this experience. And what we talk about more than anything is the idea of changing those thoughts, especially with, you know, I work a lot with guys coming out of prison, and they're in domestic violence situations. And that's like changing somebody's religion, because a lot of times they've been raised in environments where, you know, love and respect and trust and all those words, all those filters that you talked about, create these really uncomfortable emotional situations. And to talk to them about getting comfortable with their emotions would be to deny the fact that, you know, that their language is off, or that their filters are off, or that their, you know, their verbiage is off. Am I missing? I don't know. Maybe we're talking at cross points here, and I don't, you know, I appreciate what you're saying, and I hope you don't mind me delving deeper into this, because I like doing this. But
I do,
you know,
too, Rusty.
I'm really
I'm totally
in the difference.
Sure, I think this is what makes an interesting interview, actually. My thesis is this, and it's not just mine. I can go to a lot of resources if you're interested. We feel before we think. It's just that simple. When we're babies, when we're really little, we are all about feelings. We are all about emotions. We are not thinking. By the time we start thinking, we have had years of emotional experiences. Our culture and our parents and our schools have taught us that those emotional experiences, those feelings, mean certain things. And one of the primary things that they mean is whether they're safe or not. So if we don't have ways that are safe, that feel safe to express our emotions, that 13-year-old or that 16-year-old who's feeling like suiciding out, and I have a, you know, I think of one of my own nephews who blew his head off with a shotgun on Thanksgiving morning because he couldn't deal with his feelings. So I have a very personal, very, very personal stories about this stuff, and that's one of the reasons that I have been felt so driven to try to understand this, at least so that it makes sense for me. I can appreciate it may not make sense for other people. The point I want to get to here is that long before we're thinking, we're feeling. So to say that somehow our thoughts create our emotions, and I know this is controversial, I appreciate that, and I don't expect anybody to buy it, but I still feel this way, and that is that we've got it exactly backwards. And the reason why we have so much trouble with this, and let's face it, our emotional issues are at the core of virtually every issue that you're dealing with your young people, I guarantee.
But that doesn't change. That doesn't change the chicken or the egg argument. You know, I disagree with you at any level that emotionality is at the root of our problems. But that does not change the chicken or the egg argument at all.
So here's a couple of pieces. One is when we can change our thinking, really change it, we can change our lives. I totally believe that. I live it. However, in order to get that clear thinking, to really change our thinking, we need to be able to work with the 90% of our brain that is basically running subconscious programming that we don't think about on a day-to-day basis, or we're just not aware of it. It's like, you know, a fish in water. We've never had it called into question. We've never thought about it. It's just, you know, the way things are. Except that it isn't, you know, in stone. It's just another story that if we're willing, I mean, believe me, I've been in rooms with thousands of teenagers. I've watched kids go from being really depressed and down and angry to being filled with joy and running around a room at the end of the day. If you've been to a challenge day, you know what I mean. So you know, I know what's possible. Sharon Begley, the science writer for Newsweek, just in the last couple of weeks wrote an article about some of the latest research that shows that even one exposure to more conscious awareness of some issue in a young person's life over time, longitudinal studies, show that it has a really positive outcome. And I'm here to tell you that I've seen this hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of times, where when people get a sense of emotional literacy, they are able to process their feelings, empty that emotional balloon, their health improves, their outlook improves, and their ability to be a really engaged person in the world radically improves.
Okay, and so I, you know, again, I think, you know, we're both basically heading in the same direction, and we'll just figure out, you know, as we go forward. And I appreciate that research, because I actually do a lot of assemblies, and I always worry about being a one-hit wonder and bringing in some of these ideas at that level. I usually try coming into an assembly of 6th, 7th, and 8th graders by dancing, and it just freaks them out. They don't know how to react. And then my first question is, what were you thinking as I walked into the room? You know, and you'll have a moment of silence where they'll be like, what do you mean, what was I thinking? And so we try and draw them into that emotional experience, whether they thought it was cool or it was stupid or whether they were embarrassed by it. So I'm glad to hear that the research points that out. But one of the key focuses of my show are practical tools that people can use. So if you wouldn't mind, maybe we can talk for the next period of time about some of the practical ways. You talked about coaching, and you know, I know the challenge day is a powerful thing, and it does tend to especially the cross the line experience, where a lot of kids get the opportunity to at least walk a moment in somebody else's shoes, and I appreciate that. But what are some of the other tools that you use when you're coaching and working with people that really help them to kind of find some sense of, or at least begin the process of figuring these emotions or thoughts out?
The central thing that I do with every one of my clients is I work with them to develop some kind of a practice. You can call it a spiritual practice. If you're not spiritually oriented, you can just call it a mindfulness practice. And the idea is to, and this does take some time. It's not a, you know, 3 steps in 2 days and you're done. You know, we've spent a lifetime developing the habits and patterns we have, the neuronal pathways that are so deeply implanted, and so it takes some time to create new neuronal pathways. The good news is that we can. And so being present in the moment, really being present with the isness, and not being attached to a thought, not being attached to anything at all, is really, really, to me, at the core of all of this healing, all of this work that we can do. And so I just have people spend some time focusing on their breath, noticing that thoughts come and go, and that they are not any of their thoughts. They get them in touch with their ever-present awareness. And then I help them see that they, because these thoughts come and go, and that some of the thoughts that they have the effect of taking a physical sensation in the body, for example, and making it mean something that they find uncomfortable or scary, they can choose another story, which is just another thought, and have a different experience. And then also, if they find themselves, and I call this being triggered, you probably know what that means, I assume, very much triggered. So once you're triggered, what are strategies you can use? And I have various kinds of a challenge. They call them attention outs. But they're ways to, as soon as we realize we've been triggered, then we are already well along the path of getting back out into a more centered place. And I think we're probably really talking about the same things. It's just that I think that that everybody I've ever worked with, Rusty, has a lot of unresolved emotional issues going on. And to be able to just say, well, just drop it. I just haven't found that people have that ability. It's kind of like PTSD, you know? I think most of us are running around with some form of PTSD. And that's not to demean in any way or lessen the profound PTSD that a lot of our soldiers are coming back with and have always had. I mean, my father was a 19-year-old on the front lines in Germany and World War II, and, you know, he had issues all his life. We just didn't talk about it. You know, he just had other coping mechanisms, like getting really rageful, for example. So what happens if we don't deal with our emotions? They leak out on people, often the people who are closest to us and feel like they're the safest people for us to be our biggest jerks around, because they're not going to leave us, hopefully. And so my goal in working with clients is to help people develop an understanding, an awareness of what's going on so that they can make different choices. Because I think without awareness, without being aware in the present moment, it's impossible to make different choices.
Well, getting in touch with that internal dialogue, I will agree with you. You know, and I think that you know, I don't give Freud that much credit, and you talked about a 90% subconscious. My experience, I think, of going through this process for 45 years has been a lot about trying to bring what I might have considered subconscious into the conscious realm, and I'm not sure that that's something that isn't the responsibility of consciousness going forward, is realizing that these things do, you know, you wake up in the morning, you got a song stuck in your head, or you've got these things, and I can't go to sleep at night because I'm worried about my kid's future, and there's nothing I can do about that. And becoming aware of those thoughts and realizing that in fact is something that we can, you know, change, that we can think different ways and so forth. Obviously, the trauma and the tragedy that you talk about, for example, losing your friend when you were 16 or 17 to a motorcycle accident, there's a pureness to that level of emotionality that I don't think exists in a lot of times in the rest of our experiences. I think it's kind of like you talk about PTSD. Yes, there are pure PTSD cases, and there are pure addiction cases, and there are pure cases of ADHD, and those are incredibly rare. Most of the rest of them are situations where people are experiencing things, and you know, there's certain levels of that. But you know, emotionality that's pure, that's something that can't be argued, or something that, you know, is not being sought. And you talked about that in the early infancy. I think those primary emotions of safety, security, those are the basic emotions that came with the wetware. But as far as moving forward in this whole, you know, barrage of emotions that we're talking about, you know, I talk to kids every year. I said, it's like, you know, most kids, they have glad, sad, and mad. Those are the three emotions they're comfortable with. And I said, that's black, white, and gray. And we have this entire palette of other emotions that are available to us. And those are true. But at the same time, what you're talking about, the basic emotionality, safety and security, fight or flight, I mean, that's old brain stuff.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of that fear that's being created, a lot of that fear that's causing the reactions that you talked about, the cortisol reactions in the body and so forth, is based on people living in fear. I mean, I think that's where they spend most of their time. They're afraid.
Absolutely.
They're not experiencing a whole range of different emotions that they're missing out on. They're scared. And they're bottom line scared to death on a daily basis of how they're going to make things work. And they, you know, most of the guys that I deal with in domestic violence, it's about power and control. It's not about emotions. It's about power and control and fear. And most guys' inability to stand on the precipice of an intense relationship without being scared to death of losing it, and they react in a violent way.
Rusty, that's exactly what I'm talking about too. Is that there is an emotion here? It's the emotion of fear.
Well, then those are the primary emotions, and you know, we don't expand that over the, you know, across the spectrum of, you know, all the colors of the rainbow in terms of that. If fear is the primary emotion, then we deal with it from that perspective. And I don't disagree that fear is a primary emotion. That one,
yes,
I don't think requires any thinking. And a baby who can experience fear, it's interesting that Einstein said that a baby will cry almost immediately. It takes them almost 2 years before they, or not 2 years, but an extended period of time before they learn how to laugh. And that speaks highly of the development of consciousness over that period of time.
Yeah, well, the fMRI brain scans have mapped the five most primitive emotions, which is fear, you know, panic is the extreme version of fear, anger and rage is the extreme version of that, the seeking behavior, lust, and separation anxiety. Those are the five that go down into the reptilian brain, the part that just sits on top of the brainstem. And so those five very primitive emotions have been in, you know, around for 100 million years or more. And so they're very powerful and very strong, and when people understand that our ears and our eyes have really huge neuronal pathways that run right down to the amygdala and right into the brainstem, and bypass the cerebral cortex completely. That's why we can go, well, I shouldn't be afraid now. I shouldn't feel this. And yet we do because of all of the training we've received and also because the startle reflex and all those kinds of things, I know you know about all this stuff, have these really deep visceral reactions in the body. And, you know, and then we, of course we're all addicted to adrenaline, and I believe that trauma is locked into cellular memory with adrenaline. And that's why I feel that talk therapy is often not as useful as it might be, because it doesn't address the cellular issue. It doesn't address the physical bodily issue of what's going on, which I have found can only be really successfully addressed, and I mean at the level of transforming consciousness, not just a coping mechanism, but really healing and moving on. So it's just not an issue anymore. It comes from being willing to run the energy that we've had locked away in healthy and safe ways, and then it dissipates. And when we learn how to safely and responsibly dissipate emotional energy when it builds up, and we do that on a regular basis in a conscious and loving and healthy way, we're a lot easier to be around in the world. We're not going to be doing road rage and having these amazingly, intensely angry episodes, because that's, you know, what happens when our balloon gets too full, it starts leaking. And when somebody commits suicide or commits a murder, that's how they deal with that overwhelming emotional state. You know, we don't think passion, we feel passion. And, you know, a 15-year-old music virtuoso who knocks over Carnegie Hall with the passion of their playing, I don't believe that passion's any different than a 50-year-old Yo-Yo Ma who is knocking over Carnegie Hall with the passion of his playing. That's the same place. It's the same core heart passion.
Well, I would think that'd be unfortunate then, because there's 35 years of practice and blood, sweat, and tears in between those two things. So if that wine didn't get any sweeter with time, and I apologize for the analogy, then I don't think it'd be much to look forward to, because if you can feel it at 15 the same way you could feel it at 50, what would be the purpose?
Well, for me, I have been totally in love with nature since I've been a little boy. I've been knocked over by sunset since I was a little boy. To say that somehow I'm more knocked over now than I was when I was 12, I don't think that does my 12-year-old justice. I don't think that's an honoring thing to say.
When you realize that you've got a lot less of them to see than you did when you were 12, would mean that it would be much more precious just from that one perspective, is the realization that, you know what, when I was 12 years old, I had no sense of my own mortality, and now I do. So therefore, there is something more precious about these sunsets than there was at that period of time. And again, that goes back to those scripts. You know, the point of the matter is that I think the thinking brain can not only help you manage emotions and create emotions, but it can also help you to experience the ones that you want to, you know. I mean, I think that's part of the process, too, is we feel like we're a slave to the emotionality, or at some level the other day I was at in front of 850 kids. It was the largest assembly I've ever done for kids, and there's 850 kids, and I, walking in there, I knew I was supposed to be afraid. You know, I was like, I'm supposed to be afraid. You know, that's the natural experience. You're supposed to be afraid. It's like playing a football game or doing anything else. You're supposed to experience that fear. But the idea that the great athletes or you know, the people that are out there that they're not experiencing the same feelings that everybody else is the idea that I don't think that's true. I think they are experiencing them. I just don't think they pay any attention to them. I think they're there. You know, when Derek Jeter's trying to hit a fastball in the World Series in Game 7, and there's two, you know, it's a 3-2 count with two outs, I think he's just as afraid as anybody else. I just don't think he pays any attention to it.
I think he probably uses it.
Yeah,
I said before, I think that fear is excitement without breath. And so that when you're breathing as you walk in, I do some public speaking, I've been terrified, and I'm not like I used to be. And part of that is getting used to it, being more comfortable with these intense sensations. They're intense sensations. We label them as fear, and then we are taught that we shouldn't feel that way, or that it's something that's uncomfortable. It's simply an intense sensation. it's not good or bad, right or wrong, scary or not scary, until we're taught that. And so we can learn a different way of being with this intense emotionality that's called, and I call that emotional literacy, and it sounds like you're doing a lot of the very similar things, and then we are able to think more clearly because we're not at the effect of our emotions. You know, people talk about being a slave to their emotions.
The preparation for me walking into that room was the realization 2 weeks in advance that it didn't make any difference how it went. You know, if I realized that I was a work in progress, and that, you know, if it went great, good. If it went bad, I would learn from it. And if I fell on my face, that the idea that I walked into that room without the least, and truthfully, which was a surprise to me, there wasn't any fear associated with it. The idea was is that I was able to think my way past those emotions well in advance of them even happening, based on what my expectations were and what I expected my outcomes to be. And what I would accept as an outcome, and that's another thing you talked about, the perfectionism idea. I accepted as an outcome the possibility that I would fall flat on my face, that my jokes wouldn't work, that the kids wouldn't laugh, that the teachers wouldn't accept it. And was that okay? Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that narcissistic shattering that happens to a lot of us men is that fear of us looking stupid. And again, it goes back to fear, and I don't know. I mean, I'm going to walk away from our very intelligent conversation, which I've appreciated very much, with some sense of a renewed interest in the concept of fear, because at some level, you express 5 primary emotions, but I would think 4 of those, at least, with the exception of lust, could be expressed as fear at some level, because I always think of anger as being a reaction as opposed to an emotion anyway, so... But it's really interesting to think about, because I think fear is may be the primary mover when it comes to emotionality, at least from the negative perspective. Maybe love's the other side of that. I don't know.
Well, I think that fear is certainly, I believe, at the core, because we're talking about survival, you know, and I think that it's deeply programmed in at the genetic level to survive through procreation and raising young. I think that's going on at a level that has nothing to do with our cerebral cortex. I think that our cerebral cortex makes up stories about what's going on really deeply down in at the core of our triune brain. But from the research I've seen, we do not have really good connections between the cortex and the mammalian brain and the reptilian brain. And
have you read the book, The Selfish Gene?
Was that Doc?
He talks about the fact that genetically we're being, you know, that's actually what's going on at a very genetic level. It's not about the human, it's not about the survival of the body, it's the survival of the gene.
I understand, I definitely have read about him, and I've read, I haven't read the book, but I've read, reviews of the book and so on, and I've certainly had discussions with people about whether that's so or not. And again, I can't speak to the so-ness, I can speak to whether, ultimately, I think a lot of this stuff has to do with, is it useful? And I don't find that a particularly useful discussion to have with people. The average 15-year-old doesn't give a holy, anything about that kind of thing. It's like, how am I going to show up in school? What am I going to do when I get bullied or teased or harassed again and I feel like dying or killing somebody? And, of course, we see that's the other side. In Columbine and lots of different situations where the kids who've been bullied the most are the ones who often wind up pulling the trigger and going right after the kids that bullied them the most. And I think ultimately that is about this rage that comes up. When somebody really scares us, one of the very typical reactions is to get really angry. And yes, underneath the anger is fear. I totally understand that. Believe me, as someone who's been bullied a lot, I've been there. But I have a deep empathy, not approval at any level, but an empathy for why someone who's been horribly bullied and humiliated publicly would do something like some of these kids have done. There have been times in my life, Rusty, when if I had a gun in my hand, I would have used it. I just, that's the truth of my shadow, is that I was that angry and that out of control. And it was because I didn't have any skills around working with my emotions.
Well, that's what we're here to provide. I think we've run out of time. I can't thank you enough for being with me here today. And, I live in the orchards in Northern California, and I get the joy, well, you live in the wine country, so But I get to walk
where
around
do you live
at different times of the year and look at the as everything changes and those trees produce and then they die and they're in the death period right now where they go into that
right. That
period of time. And it's interesting to me. I don't know that I believe in reincarnation, but it would be an interesting idea if you got a chance to do it over and over and over again. And each time you come through that you produce a different level. You're obviously producing at a very high level now and touching people's lives. And I encourage you in everything that you're doing, and I appreciate your time here today.
Thanks, Rusty. I appreciate what you're doing in the world. I know that what you're doing makes a huge difference to young people who get to experience you, and I just want to appreciate you for that.
All right, man. Have a great evening.
Thanks. You too. Thanks for having me on.
All right. Thank you, everybody that's out there listening tonight. As always, you can email me at radiorusty@hotmail.com. I'd love to hear from you. If you have any questions about Steve, please.
Can I just say real quickly,
yeah.
Rusty? I forgot to mention that if anybody's interested in more of what I'm talking about, my book, Drunk with Wonder, is available on Amazon, or it's on my website, drunkwithwonder.com.
Perfect.
Thanks a lot.
Steve.
Okay, bye-bye.
All right, everybody, thank you very much for joining us again. And remember, it's all about the conversation. Have a great evening. Thank you, Don.
Hi, my name is Rusty May, and I'm the host of The Conscious Communicator, a show dedicated to helping people find their true voice, the nonviolent voice of personal responsibility and purpose, the voice that only they can speak. The reason that most of us fail to achieve our true voice is because of the false voices that occupy the mind, the voices of ego, consumption, expectation, opinion, and self-doubt rob us of our true nature, our true voice. Join me each week for a chat about inner purpose, outer passion, and finding your true voice. I'll see you on Sunday.